You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, thanks for downloading the 66th episode of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all, welcome to the podcast. Rich and I used the last two shows to talk about the mayhem that broke out in the important border state of Missouri at the start of the Civil War. And we closed out the last episode with the Battle of Carthage, a clash that ended up being a dramatic running fight in which Franz Ziegel's outnumbered Federals finally succeeded in escaping from Claiborne Fox Jackson's state guardsmen.
While that drama was playing out off to the north, back at Boonville, Nathaniel Lyon had received reinforcements from Iowa and had finally assembled his supply train. And so on July 3rd, he started marching his 2,350 men south through the Missouri countryside in a belated pursuit of Jackson and the State Guard. As Lyon's force marched steadily southward, it was joined by a column of 2,200 regulars and Kansas volunteers under the command of Samuel Sturgis. The Kansans had joined the regulars at Fort Leavenworth, and then together they'd marched on to Kansas City, and from there Sturgis's column moved to link up with Lyon. Sturgis was a West Pointer, a Mexican War veteran, and had seen considerable action on the frontier fighting Indians. When the Civil War started, he'd been in command of a couple companies of cavalry at Fort Smith, Arkansas. To avoid capture, Sturgis and his men evacuated that imperiled post in April 1861 and had made their way north to Kansas.
After Sturgis and Lyon linked up, they learned on July 9th that Ziegel's force had retreated from Carthage several days earlier and that the German was being pursued by Jackson's State Guard as he made his way to Springfield, but he was in danger of being surrounded and destroyed. That news wasn't true. Jackson's State Guardsmen were in no condition to vigorously pursue Ziegel. Nevertheless, the faulty intelligence and the seeming prospect of Ziegel's imminent annihilation caused intense excitement in Lyon's command and prompted him to hurry his troops toward Springfield on a rapid forced march. In a letter to a hometown newspaper, one of the Iowans, a fellow named Ralph Zeblin, wrote that, quote, "We had a hot southern sun to march under, but we kept on with but very few failing. The dust and heat were oppressive. Along the roadside were strewed by scores the regulars, as we called the United States troops, and the Missouri volunteers," end quote. But after that jab at the others, Zeblin admitted, quote, "I carried myself along more asleep than awake," end quote. After 2 days of exhausting marching in the brutal heat, covering more than 50 miles, Lyon received word that Ziegel's force was safe at Springfield. Upon receiving that welcome news, Lyon eased up on the killing pace, and then riding ahead of his foot-sore and weary column, he arrived in Springfield on the evening of July 13th.
But after arriving in Springfield, Lyon faced a couple of problems. Even after his column linked up with the Federals already there, Lyon would still only have about 6,000 men, and that number would only shrink in the very near future as some of the volunteers' 90-day enlistments expired. And then, since the town was over 100 miles from the nearest railhead at Rolla, the supply situation at Springfield was worrisome and would only grow more critical with each passing day. With the victorious State Guard still somewhere nearby, and with a Confederate force of unknown strength likely coming up from Arkansas, a less headstrong, less aggressive officer than Lyon might have considered withdrawing his threadbare and hungry force from such a perilous advanced position like Springfield. But, as evidenced by his "This Means War" outburst at the Planner's House meeting back in St. Louis, there was an extremely intense fire burning inside Nathaniel Lyon. And so rather than retreat from Springfield, he meant to stick it out in the town as long as possible and use his command to punish the enemy.
Born in Connecticut in 1818, Nathaniel Lyon graduated from West Point in 1841, 11th in his class. After graduation, he was appointed a second lieutenant in the infantry and was stationed in Florida during the Second Seminole War. In 1847, Lyon was promoted to first lieutenant, and during the war with Mexico, he commanded a company of infantry during Winfield Scott's campaign to capture the enemy capital. Lyon fought in several of the campaign's key battles, and he received a wound during the fighting for Mexico City. He was appointed a brevet captain for his gallantry in Mexico. After that, Lyon was stationed in California in 1849, and the next year at Clear Lake, soldiers under his command massacred about 200 Indians, including women and children. In 1851, Lyon was promoted to the permanent rank of captain, and in 1854, he was transferred to the Kansas Territory. While serving in that troubled territory, he made himself infamous in the officers' mess at Fort Riley with his tirades against slavery and secessionists. Lyon joined the Republican Party, but the wiry little officer was no abolitionist. He despised slavery because he thought that its expansion into the territories would take opportunities away from whites. After Lincoln's election, as the prospect of civil war grew stronger, Lyon's fervent devotion to the Union led him to denounce secessionists with a zeal that was frightening. In January 1861, he wrote that, quote, "It is no longer useful to appeal to reason, but to the sword," end quote. That same month, he was ordered to take a small force of regulars to St. Louis and help secure the arsenal there. After that, y'all know the rest of the story from the last two episodes.
After their victory over Sigel at Carthage, Claiborne Fox Jackson and his state guardsmen continued to move toward the extreme southwestern corner of Missouri, toward an area known rather unappealingly as Cowskin Prairie, where Sterling Price had set up his camp. Brigadier General Ben McCulloch, the Confederate commander in Arkansas, had crossed the Missouri line with a small detachment and had joined Price at Cowskin Prairie. And so on July 6th, when Jackson's Missourians arrived there from Carthage, they were thrilled to see real live Confederate soldiers for the first time. Thomas Sneed, the governor's aide, said the militiamen, quote, "looked with delighted eyes on the first Confederate soldiers that we had ever seen. To look like these gallant soldiers, to be of them, to fight beside them for their homes and for our own, was the one desire of all Missourians," end quote. But McCulloch, a Texan, was far less impressed with the ragtag state guardsmen. Sneed thought that the Confederate officer, quote, "saw in the Missourians nothing but a half-armed mob led by an ignorant old militia general," end quote.
Born in Tennessee in 1811, Benjamin McCulloch followed his friend and neighbor, Davy Crockett, to Texas in 1835. Unable to reach San Antonio before the fall of the Alamo, McCulloch served with Sam Houston at the Battle of San Jacinto. McCulloch then embarked on a successful career as a Texas Ranger and Indian fighter. In 1839, he was elected to the Texas House of Representatives. During the Mexican War, McCulloch served brilliantly under Zachary Taylor during the fighting in northern Mexico and gained a national reputation as commander of a company of tough Texans and as Taylor's chief of scouts. During the 1849 gold rush, McCulloch ventured out to California, hoping to strike it rich, but failing to find his fortune there, he returned to Texas. Secretary of War Jefferson Davis considered him for the colonelcy of the newly formed 2nd U.S. Cavalry Regiment, but Davis instead gave the command to McCulloch's fellow Texan, Albert Sidney Johnston. In 1854, McCulloch became a U.S. Marshal in Texas. With the secession of the Lone Star State after Abraham Lincoln's inauguration, McCulloch became a colonel of Texas State Militia, and then in May 1861, he was commissioned a brigadier general in the Confederate Army.
With the state guardsmen now delivered into the hands of Sterling Price at Cowskin Prairie, McCulloch thought the Missourians were at least temporarily safe, so he returned to his camp across the Arkansas border. Meanwhile, Claiborne Fox Jackson set out on a campaign to try to drum up support for Missouri's liberation from federal domination. He first went to Little Rock, then to Memphis, and finally, by the end of July, he was in Virginia for a meeting with Jefferson Davis in Richmond. While Jackson did what he could diplomatically, Sterling Price and his subordinates at Cowskin Prairie worked to transform their rough-and-tumble state guardsmen into soldiers. Veterans of the Mexican War, the regular army, or pre-war militia outfits served as drill instructors. But still, a few weeks of training and drilling could only do so much. In his book, Campaign for Wilson's Creek, The Fight for Missouri Begins, Jeffrey Patrick explains that, quote, "The state guardsmen at Cowskin Prairie were more reminiscent of militia forces of earlier American wars than the armies of the Civil War. Most of the Missourians made do without extensive camp equipage, uniforms, military weapons, or even a variety of rations. Although some were lucky enough to sleep under canvas, many simply bivouacked in the open with their blankets. Civilian clothing was prominent in the ranks, together with civilian shotguns and hunting rifles. Simple rations of beef and flour were issued to new soldiers who tried their hand at cooking and company messes. Fortunately, guardsmen with spending money could purchase foodstuffs from local farmers. Those without could ask for donations from sympathetic civilians." End quote.
While the State Guard organized and trained at Cowskin Prairie, the supply situation had not improved for Nathaniel Lyon's force at Springfield. The news of the Union defeat at First Manassas, rumors that a large enemy force was gathering to the southwest, and increasingly scarce rations all combined to make the federal volunteers and regulars glum and anxious. While newspapers told the people of St. Louis that Lyon's men were, quote, well-provisioned and provided with abundant ammunition, end quote, the Federals were actually munching on meager rations, mending their tattered uniforms, and praying for reinforcements. After several weeks biding their time in Springfield, one of the Iowa volunteers described a typical member of his regiment in this way, quote, "His beard and hair are long, shaggy, and untrimmed. His hat is pierced with holes in the crown and sides. His flannel shirt is out at the elbows and torn across the back. His pants have lost half of their side stripe, are out at the knees, torn and fringed around the ankles. He has no socks, and his feet peep through his shoes, and are only retained upon his feet by a most ingenious application of strings and strips of leather. Until within a day or two past, we have been living upon what is called one-quarter rations, which means from one-quarter to one-half of a hard cracker at a meal, with coffee once or twice a day, and occasionally a bit of fat bacon or fresh beef as large as one's two fingers." End quote.
With Lyon's deteriorating supply situation at Springfield, and with Sterling Price working feverishly to organize and train the state guardsmen at Cowskin Prairie, the wild card in the mix would be Ben McCulloch and his Confederates just across the state line in northwest Arkansas. Although McCulloch believed the Missourians were badly organized, poorly armed, and not prepared for active service, he nonetheless readied his Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas regiments to move north and unite with Price and go on the offensive against Lyon. McCulloch, unaware of Lyon's predicament, believed that if the Southerners didn't unite and strike hard at the Federals, Lyon would come on from Springfield and attack them. Besides, the area around Cowskin Prairie was too poor to sustain Price's force for long, and so McCulloch realized that the state guardsmen would soon be forced to move or disband. And so in late July, after giving Sterling Price 3 weeks to train as militiamen, Ben McCulloch decided the time had come for him to march his Confederates north from Arkansas and join the Missouri State Guard in an attempt to drive the Federals from Springfield.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
On July 25th, Sterling Price began moving his state guardsmen from Cowskin Prairie to Cassville, where he would rendezvous with McCulloch's force. Besides about 2,700 Confederate soldiers from Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas, McCulloch was also bringing around 2,200 Arkansas state troops commanded by Nicholas Bartlett Pierce. Pierce, a West Point graduate, opposed secession, but he believed it was his duty to stand by his state when Arkansas left the Union. He was named a brigadier general by Arkansas Governor Henry Rector and appointed to command the Western Division of the state's militia. McCulloch's mixed force reached Cassville on July 29th and was greeted with wild enthusiasm by the Missourians.
With three generals in the southern camp, Pierce, Price, and McCulloch, the question arose of just who was in overall command of the coalition of Arkansas militia, Missouri State Guard, and Confederate troops. But since Pierce and Price only held state commissions, they informally agreed that for the upcoming campaign, McCulloch would lead the combined force. And so, on July 30th, the Texan sent a message to Richmond, stating that it was his intention to, quote, move toward Springfield as rapidly as possible with the entire force and hope to put the Missourians again in possession of it, end quote. But as Jeffrey Patrick points out in his book, Campaign for Wilson's Creek, quote, although on the surface all seemed well with the commanders of the Southern Coalition Army, there existed an underlying current of mistrust fostered by their different backgrounds and experiences. Price and McCulloch had been volunteer officers in the Mexican War, but Price had seen relatively little combat and had pursued a political career after the conflict. To his credit, Price was brave and could inspire the citizen soldiers of his newly formed State Guard as no other officer could. But as a man with a large ego, Price was known throughout the war for difficulties with superiors and fellow generals. His counterpart was equally brave, self-confident, and idolized by his troops, but McCulloch was an unpretentious, practical commander. He had seen considerable action in Mexico, was a student of military history, and was more of an organizer and disciplinarian. McCulloch answered to Jefferson Davis alone and was under considerable pressure to achieve decisive results in southwest Missouri. End quote.
As the Southern Army moved out on the 50-mile march to Springfield following what was known locally as the Telegraph Road or Wire Road, which was the main road leading from Fayetteville, Arkansas through Cassville, Missouri, and up to Springfield. As the Southern Army moved out along the Wire Road, one source of tension between McCulloch and Price was the large number of unarmed men accompanying the march. You see, by the end of July, Price's State Guard now numbered more than 5,000 armed men, as well as another 2,000 unarmed volunteers. McCulloch had urged Price to leave the unarmed men behind at Cowskin Prairie, and the Missourian had agreed, but the men had still shown up at Cassville. knowing that the presence of the mob of unarmed men would only exacerbate the Army's logistical difficulties once the march on Springfield got underway. McCulloch again called on Price to leave them behind, and Price again agreed. But when the march up the wired road began, an exasperated McCulloch discovered that the unarmed Missourians were still accompanying the Army.
Meanwhile, in Springfield, Lyon had hoped that the July 25th arrival in St. Louis of the new commander of the Western Department, John Fremont, would start a flow of supplies and reinforcements. But Lyon's predicament was just one of the pressing concerns Fremont had to deal with in his sprawling new command. And besides, to Fremont's way of thinking, Lyon could always abandon Springfield, withdraw to the railhead at Rolla, reorganize and resupply his force, and then move back into southwestern Missouri. And so Lyon soon learned that if he stayed in Springfield, he'd get no support from Fremont. The new department commander's attitude suggested that Lyon could decide to remain in Springfield or withdraw to Rolla, but any disaster that befell him would be Lyon's responsibility. The aggressive Lyon, however, was still in no mood to fall back from Springfield, despite his steadily worsening supply situation, and so he made plans to attack the enemy. He'd received faulty intelligence that McCulloch and Price still hadn't linked up, so Lyon planned to strike and defeat each enemy force in turn before they combined. To that end, Lyon led his army out of Springfield on the Wire Road on August 1st.
In stifling heat and raising clouds of choking dust as they marched along, Lyon's men moved down the Wire Road even as the Southern Army moved up the same road toward Springfield. On August 2nd, the advance guards of the two opposing forces collided at Doug Springs, about 15 miles southwest of Springfield. In the skirmish that took place at Doug Springs, Lyon's advance force, consisting of four companies of regulars and a battery of artillery, trounced the Arkansans and Missourians that made up the Southern advance guard. McCulloch believed the Missourians had behaved especially shamefully during the affair at Doug Springs, and so the incident ratcheted up the tension between Price and McCulloch yet another notch.
Even though his troops had won the skirmish at Doug Springs, Lyon was now uncertain as to whether or not he ought to risk battle. He cautiously continued his advance, but on the morning of August 4th, he held a council of war in order to chart his next course of action. Lyon now believed that even if the separate enemy columns hadn't actually united, they were at least now within supporting distance of one another, which he thought meant about 15,000 enemy troops were at this point probably only about 6 or so miles away. And so when Lyon asked his lieutenants whether the Federal Army ought to fall back to Springfield or ought to continue to seek battle with the Southerners, every officer except Sigel voted to fall back. Well, the brutal heat, lack of water, and fatigue made the march back up the Wire Road to Springfield a demoralizing affair, and Lyon's men staggered back into the town on August 5th. Despite the fact that he had made it back safely without the enemy attacking his retreating column, Lyon realized he was still in a difficult spot. Lyon despaired of receiving reinforcements from Fremont. Supplies at Springfield were scarce. Some of the men were now without shoes, and, of course, the Southern Army was still approaching. But even though the situation appeared bleak, as Lyon once again discussed options with his subordinates, he decided to stay in Springfield.
Meanwhile, Ben McCulloch had also been making some difficult decisions. For whatever reason, the Texan, who up until now had shown admirable decisiveness, seems to have suddenly expressed serious doubts about the wisdom of continuing the advance toward Springfield. Perhaps McCulloch merely wanted to wait to see what Lyon's next move would be. Certainly the debacle at Doug Springs had caused him to further doubt the reliability of his Missouri allies. But when it became apparent that McCulloch might not seek battle with the Federals, Sterling Price apparently confronted the Texan, either at a council of war or perhaps privately, and the Missourian offered to formally give McCulloch command of the state guardsmen if only McCulloch would agree to continue the advance and attack the enemy. Price may have even threatened to break away from the coalition army if McCulloch didn't seek to bring the Federals to battle. In any case, in return for McCulloch ordering the advance up the Wire Road to continue, on August 4th, Price officially announced to his state guardsmen that the Confederate officer was now the, quote, supreme commander, end quote, of the coalition force, and the Missourians were directly subject to McCulloch's orders.
That same day, McCulloch issued orders that the men of the Southern Army were to prepare themselves to march at midnight. They would advance up the Wire Road and, come morning, surprise the enemy in their camp. And so the Confederate soldiers from Louisiana, Arkansas, and Texas, the Missouri State Guardsmen, and the Arkansas State Troops all spent the afternoon and evening of August 4th preparing for the night march and for a decisive battle with the Federals. By midnight, as ordered, the Southerners were moving out. A Louisianan, William Watson, recalled that, quote, "the silence and steadiness of that march in the dark night up that solitary road, lined on each side with the black frowning woods, seemed truly grand," end quote. Another soldier from Louisiana, W. H. Tunnard, said that he and his comrades marched along quietly and, quote, "in anticipation of meeting almost certain death, but with undaunted, unquailing spirits," end quote. But after sunrise on the morning of August 5th, the eager Southerners were disappointed to discover that the Federals had abandoned their advance and were withdrawing back up the road towards Springfield.
Upon finding that the Federals were withdrawing, some of the Southern officers thought Lyon was trying to draw them into a trap, but McCulloch ordered the advance to continue. When the men moved forward cautiously for fear of stumbling into a Federal ambush, a frustrated McCulloch finally rode on ahead with a small group of well-armed Texans, the Army commander personally acting as a scout to inspire his men to push rapidly ahead. And so, under the broiling August sun, the Southerners plowed ahead through the heat and dust, hoping to catch up to the retreating enemy. Thomas Bacon, a Missouri State Guardsman, wrote that, quote, "all that day we raced along. The dust was thick and gritty. It was a fearful march. I remember one well, but the soldiers soon exhausted it. Masses of them swarmed and crowded around that well, and I moved on in despair," end quote. On the second day of such marching, the parched men of the Southern Army reached the valley of Wilson's Creek, about 10 miles southwest of Springfield, and there, where shade trees lined the creek's banks and abundant clear water flowed over the stream's gravel bed, McCulloch allowed his weary troops to rest.
In Springfield, Lyon called another council of war on the night of August 7th. Besides the lack of supplies, the Federal commander now had to face the prospect that he was about to lose a couple of thousand men from his small army as the enlistments of some of his volunteers began to expire over the next few weeks. Despite that, Lyon still stubbornly argued that the army should stay in Springfield, but most of his officers voted for a retreat from the town. Seeming to bow to the inevitable, Lyon agreed to abandon Springfield, and his subordinates left the meeting, thinking that an order for the troops to prepare to move out would soon be given. But in a private conversation with Lyon, Captain Sweeney strongly objected to retreating. Painting a picture of a 100-mile retreat under the brutal sun, harried every step of the way by the pursuing Southerners, Sweeney managed to convince Lyon that the army ought to stay in Springfield long enough to give battle to the enemy. Sweeney advised Lyon to wait until the Southern army drew closer to Springfield, then quickly march out and strike a surprise blow to throw the enemy off balance. And then the Federal army could retreat from Springfield while the Southerners were still reeling from the unexpected attack. Lyon, swayed by Sweeney's argument, called yet another council of war on the night of August 8th. At that meeting, Lyon and Sweeney argued for first striking the Southerners a crippling blow so they could not follow the army as it retreated from Springfield. And all the officers present agreed to this course of action. Although they disagreed with a risky idea Sigel proposed to divide the army into two columns, one commanded by Lyon, the other by himself, in order to strike the enemy from opposite directions. Well, with the decision to make a straight-on attack made, Lyon ordered the troops to rest for a day and prepare to move from Springfield the next evening. They would then strike the Southerners a surprise blow on the morning of August 10th.
But Zeigel wasn't willing to give up on his idea, so he went to see Lyon late on the afternoon of August 9th. During a two-hour meeting, the German somehow convinced his commander that the odds of a Federal success against the larger enemy force would be greatly enhanced if Lyon and Zeigel divided the army into two columns and attacked the Southerners simultaneously from two directions. When Lyon informed his other officers of the revised plan of attack, they were apprehensive and expressed misgivings, thinking it dangerous to divide their smaller army in the face of the enemy. But Lyon overrode their objections. And so the last-minute change of plans meant that when the Federal Army marched from Springfield, Lyon would advance through the darkness with 4,200 men and strike the northern end of the enemy camp, while Zeigel took about 1,200 men and swung around and hit the southern end of the rebels' encampment. As the Federals marched out of Springfield on the evening of the 9th, clouds rolled in over the prairie, thunder boomed, and then rain began to fall.
Meanwhile, ironically, McCulloch had also decided that his army would move out on the evening of August 9th, march through the darkness, and surprise the Federals in Springfield the next morning. But as the rain started to fall on the evening of the 9th, McCulloch and Price agreed to postpone the attack. It seems this was because many of the men, especially the Missourians, either carried old flintlocks, or if they did have rifle muskets, they lacked proper cartridge boxes, and so the Southern officers feared that if the state guardsmen marched through the night in a pouring rain, they'd arrive at Springfield in the morning with wet powder or with paper cartridges that had been soaked and ruined. The Southerners were already desperately short of small arms ammunition, so the prospect that much of what they did carry might be ruined during a wet night march was apparently enough to convince McCulloch and Price to wait out the rain.
But by that time, the pickets around the Southerners' camp had already been recalled in anticipation of the start of the march, and after the rain started and the decision to postpone the attack was made, no one apparently remembered to send the pickets back out. And so, as the two Federal columns marched in the rain through the dark Missouri countryside toward the rebel camp, the blunder with the pickets meant that the Southerners would have virtually no warning of the approach of an enemy force.
And that seems like a suitably dramatic and suspenseful point to leave the story for this week. So next time, we'll switch gears a bit and head to Washington, D.C., and spend the episode talking about a piece of legislation that, just kidding, next week we'll be back in Southwest Missouri, right here where we left off, and we'll see what happens when the Battle of Wilson's Creek kicks off on the morning of August 10th, 1861.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation, and our recommendation this time is Campaign for Wilson's Creek, The Fight for Missouri Begins by Jeffrey L. Patrick.
This book is an excellent overview of both the battle and the campaign that preceded it, so it covers a lot of ground, but does it really well. And Mr. Patrick is or he was when this book was written, the National Park Service librarian at the Wilson's Creek National Battlefield. So there you go. As always, you can find all of our book recommendations at the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.blogspot.com.
Y'all can also go to the website to donate at least $10 to support the podcast and qualify for our t-shirt giveaway at the end of the month. This past week, Russell L. from Washington State made a donation, and so his name will go into the hat for the drawing. Rich and I also appreciated Russell's note about his personal connection to the battle at Carthage, Missouri, that we talked about last week.
And as we wrap things up, we'll just remind you that the music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is from the song Midnight on the Water, and we thank Spiritwood Music for their permission to use it. And then thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. We hope you'll join us again next time, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.